The American Warrior is on the air.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to American Warrior Radio. We're on the road today thanks to Nova Home Loans and the Denlinger team. We're broadcasting live from the largest privately funded aviation and aerospace museum in the world, Pima Air and Space Museum, 6000 East Valencia Road. A beautiful day out here to see the hundreds of aircraft and displays. Come on out and pay us a visit. Let's start with Sean Denslinger. Denlinger, why can I ever get that right, Sean? You're one of the Denlinger team with Nova Home Loans. And, Sean, you must have the coolest job in the whole wide world.
Why is it the coolest job in the whole
wide
world?
Because you get to help people find homes.
It is.
Or
it
buy
is.
Homes.
It is. It's a very rewarding job. You know, not only do we kind of get to make our own schedules and help people, but it's one of the biggest purchases you'll ever make. You know, so we want to make sure that we're educating our people, including the veterans and any other loan type that you're doing, to make sure that you're getting the best deal out there.
I tell you, when I see your Facebook page and you and your wife, who's a Navy veteran, you know, sometimes you'll post, hey, we helped this person get into a home. They didn't think they could get finance, and you took care of it. What a wonderful feeling.
It is. It's fantastic. Those are the best ones.
Now, you mentioned veteran loans in particular. This is a military show. I don't want to say you guys necessarily specialize in veterans, but there's some special programs out there that our veterans or our military listeners can take advantage of, correct?
Correct. Well, you know, they don't particularly need a special program because if they're eligible for a veteran loan, they get benefits. No down payment, no mortgage insurance. It's typically an easy loan to use, and I think that one of the facts that we've talked about in the past is only 12% of veterans use their VA eligibility, which is ridiculous.
It's crazy, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And why would you think that only 12% of veterans use their VA eligibility?
Because they're not aware of it?
I think that's the thing. I was asked that question to myself, and it has to be an education either from the client side or from the loan officer side, and they're not getting the information they need to make the right decision.
Now, you, Nova also, so we've got listeners around the country. Nova also does finance. You don't have to be in Tucson. You also finance loans in other states, correct?
We do. I can't remember the full list of states that we operate in, but definitely anywhere here in Arizona.
Okay, and so if folks want to reach you or your wife at the Denlinger team, how do they reach you? How do they get a hold of you, Sean?
The best way is going to be 520-440-0516 or www.azfamilyfirst.com.
azfamilyfirst.com.
Yep.
Okay, well, thanks so much to you and Nova for hosting another American Warrior remote. Nova is kind enough to be hosting us out. We'll be doing one remote a quarter, thanks to the Denlinger team. And so, Sean, thanks to you and your wife, your Navy veteran wife, for being here and supporting us today. Anything else you want to put in there so folks know that you're the guy to go to if they're buying a home?
Well, one other thing that I did want to mention was that I've been getting comments a lot that I only want to use my veteran loan and I'm going to buy my forever home. And you can have more than one veteran loan. You could use your veteran loan more than once. So that's a common misconception, and I don't want people to think that they can't use their loan more than once. So besides that, you know, we're educated in the loan itself. We have the best interest rates over at Nova. We've got low fees, and we're willing to take care of our veterans.
Wonderful. Sean, thank you so much again. Great to have you here, and thanks to Nova for hosting American Warrior Radio.
Thanks for having us.
Folks, as I mentioned, remote at Pima Air and Space Museum, the largest privately funded museum in the world. That's probably pretty close, but the expert on that, Scott Marchand, who's the director of Pima Air and Space Museum. Scott, thanks for having us out here at your lovely facility.
Thanks for having me out here too, Ben. Sounds like I've got the second best job in the world.
It's very cool. I mean, literally, we're here in a hangar. I'm surrounded by aircraft. I can see a Thunderbird jet over here. I got a Tomcat behind me. Lots of stuff. Scott, how long has Pima Air and Space been around?
This is actually our 41st year. We're coming up on our 41st anniversary. So we opened our doors for business in May of 1976. Our organization on paper got started in 1966, but it took quite a while to get the property developed and aircraft allocated and just all the infrastructure needs that go into establishing something like this.
How many aircraft, give or take?
Give or take right now, about 335.
Holy smokes.
Yeah.
And not just aircraft, but you have also other exhibits and displays. Are you up to how many hangars now?
We've got six display hangars out here with close to 200,000 square feet of interior space and about 85 acres of developed space outside for outdoor aircraft viewing.
Now, you don't just get a few acres and throw up some hangars and start a museum. I mean,
well,
obviously,
sort of what happened.
Well, thanks, pal.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, well, but your first major acquisition, I guess the baby that got it all started, was a B-24 Liberator that the foundation acquired in 1969, I guess it was.
Correct.
And things went from there.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's true technically from the standpoint of being the first aircraft that the museum owned outright. Mm-hmm. We had already been allocated 48 aircraft from the Mazdik storage facility across the street that's now known as AMARC. So that was really the nucleus of our collection, was what had been the Celebrity Row along Gulf Links there in the 1950s and early 1960s. But those were all loaned aircraft from the Air Force and the Navy and the Marines. So they're still owned by those agencies. So yes, you're absolutely right. The B-24 was technically our first owned aircraft.
Now, you bring up a good point, never crossed my mind. What percentage, if you have an idea, of the aircraft does the foundation own versus on loan?
You know, the ratio has wavered over the years, but we're probably close to a 50-50, 55-45 split right now, with the edge still being slightly towards loaned aircraft versus owned.
Last week we had General Tom Keck on the show. He was an SR-71 pilot, mm-hmm. told some amazing stories about that aircraft.
Yep.
On one mission, he literally landed before he took off because he said, as the way he put it, you can make the sunrise on an SR-71.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
One of your coolest acquisitions, there is an SR-71 Blackbird out here at Pima Air and Space Museum. What other sort of unique aircraft can folks look forward to seeing when they come out here?
Oh, we have all manner of unique aircraft here. One of the big ones we've acquired in the last couple of years was Boeing 787 Dreamliner, ship number 2 from Boeing. It was part of one of the 3 prototype test program aircraft. So when it retired from the test and evaluation program a few years ago, we've developed strong relationships with people in the Boeing organization over the years, and they thought we would make an excellent home for one of their flagship products.
Now, the mission of the museum is not just to show history to folks, but you've also got a significant educational component, particularly
yes.
for young people. Tell us a little more about that.
Yeah, so our focus broadly is, you know, aerospace technology and history, and the technology gets created by people who are smart and educated and have the background in science and math and engineering and really just have a passion for discovering and challenging their ideas. So we have a number of programs out here. Over the course of a year, we bring in about 28,000 school kids from the community for free for field trips, and they're on volunteer-led tours around here. And the tours, we work with the schools, and we tailor our tour information to sort of the age and background of the kids that come. So an elementary school tour will get a different shift in focus, more of a gee whiz tour versus mm-hmm. a middle school or high school group that's coming out with more sort of curricula tied in mandates from their school, and so we tailor it to suit those needs. So if you're, you know, learning of Bernoulli's principle in the classroom, you come out here and you can see how it is translated into reality with lift and thrust out here.
And that hands-on lesson is so important for young people when they're first getting started.
Sure is.
You've got some exciting new stuff out here. You've got a new exhibit, as I understand it, Scott, that's going to focus a little bit locally for our listeners here in Tucson, the A-10, Davis-Monthan, and the conflict in the Middle East. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so we have a new exhibit that's called the Bing, and that was really one of the – it was an informal – ready room relaxation, off the beaten path hangout that the A-10 pilots that were in Kandahar and Bagram got established, sort of an alternative to the more sort of uptight official places to go. You know, young guys in a faraway place, you know, need to relax. And I mean, it wasn't anything seedy, but just being able to, you know, talk freely and play video games and do all the things that, you know, mm-hmm. young pilots do. So what had happened after the installation had closed up, one of the majors, one of the squadrons, and one of the colonels with one of the reserve units had kept all this stuff from going into the garbage can over there and packed it up and brought it back, and they were kind of at loose ends as what to do with it. And a couple of their junior pilots, you know, who had been out on refresher courses out here said, hey, you know, you realize, you know, every A-10 pilot who's ever touched a stick or gone through school or earned their wings, you know, has spent time in Tucson at Davis Monthan Air Force Base. And, you know, they've been out here to the museum over the years and said, you know, they got one of the best aviation museums in the world, so maybe it would be a good fit there. So they approached us if we would be willing to accept the donation of all the things they'd acquired. And we were, of course, thrilled to do it. And, you know, one of the more significant things that came along with the collection, not only just squadron packs, but we've got, you know, rosters of all the units that were there and the time frame they're there. But almost without exception, every pilot who went through these installations who was an A-10 pilot, one of the requirements was that they pin one of their sets of wings to the border on the wing when they rotated out of here. So we have all the wings of all the A-10 pilots who were deployed to the Middle East since 2003.
Very, very cool. Just one of the many things you'll see out here. Folks, visit PimaAir.org if you want to get a sample. Come out and see us. Now, one of the things I love about this shop, Scott, is not only just the aircraft, but the people that are here that can tell stories about those actual aircraft. When we come back, we'll be joined by one of those pilots talking about his experience in Vietnam and one of the aircraft you can see out here at Pima Air and Space Museum. Stick around, folks. We'll be right back.
Those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now, back to the American Warrior.
Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. We're broadcasting live from Pima Air and Space Museum, thanks to the Denlinger team at Nova Home Loans. Now, I mentioned before, it's not just the aircraft you see here, but some of the stories and some of the personnel you might run into. Our next Belker, he's a volunteer, an Air Force veteran. Rick, welcome to American Warrior Radio.
Thank you, Ben. Pleasure.
Now, you've flown a number of aircraft out here, the O-2, the A-7, even a C-47. Let's talk real briefly, though, about the O-2. You flew several 325 missions over the Ho Chi Minh Trail over Laos in 1969 as a forward air controller. This little Cessna was first designed as a business aircraft. I don't think it was designed to be shot at, was it?
Pretty improbable-looking combat aircraft. It was a version of the Super Skymaster that Cessna put out to help pilots learn about twin engines without the yaw problems out on the wings. It was a push-me-pull-you arrangement. Propeller engine in the front, another one in the back between a couple of tail booms, a little bit of extra windows for better visibility, overloaded, lots of radios in the back to talk to people on the ground, people in the air. It was better than the O-1 Bird Dog, better endurance, better target marking rocket load. Not quite as good as the follow-on aircraft intended for sooner than it showed up, the OB-10 Bronco. So several hundred O-2s were purchased. You're right, I was on the Ho Chi Minh Highway Patrol. They called it a trail. It wasn't a trail. It was an interstate highway system. Truck parks, pipelines, telephone lines. And our job was to fly my group out of Pleiku Air Base in the Central Highlands, about as high above sea level as Tucson. We had two missions. One was visual reconnaissance, the other airstrike control. The bad guys were under 200-foot triple canopy jungle, so they weren't that easy to spot, especially by jet fighters. Our job was play detective, get familiar with the same area, go day after day, look for changes, water washed up on one side of a ford at daylight, that sort of thing. We had no armor plate, no ejection seat, no afterburner, just hoping for big sky, little bullet. We kept the airplane moving around, but we didn't cover a lot of ground in the process, so we were doing the best we could without a lot of climb away from ground fire. Once we found the bad guys, then our job was direct fighters from up above to put their ordnance where it was needed. That meant briefing them on the local area, the threats from ground fire, putting in a target marking rocket to help them find the target, then clearing them for every bomb pass, making sure the bombs went closer and closer, hopefully on the target, then going in afterwards for a bomb damage assessment.
Now, they added hard points to these little Cessnas, but you're not carrying weapons per se, right?
No.
Or not necessarily, depending on the mission.
We had as many as two pods, each held seven 2.75-inch white phosphorus smoke rounds, rockets. At night, we flew 24/7. At night, we had air flares with parachutes. The better group at marking device at night was what we call a log marker. It would just land in the sand with some thermite, put out a spot that bad guys several feet away couldn't see. Put that on a cardinal heading, use those two as a distance marker, straddle a target, and we could direct the fighters at night.
Now, you were in the Air Force, but there was almost the other branches also had forward air controllers as well, correct?
Marines had some. The Army had light aircraft, usually helicopters. Didn't really do the facking job of airstrike control as such. It was primarily an Air Force role.
Now, when you, for your mission at any particular time, were you directed to go to a particular place, or sometimes were you just up loitering, waiting for someone to call for some help? Because I think one of the advantages of your aircraft, though, is you could fly very low and very slow, correct?
We generally would stay around 2,000 feet, do just over about 100 miles an hour. We did have some pre-planned missions for known targets that we had generated by our own intelligence from our own surveillance. Sometimes things would happen where we would find a target and we would go through an airborne command post that would allocate fighters to us. The second half of my tour, I was selected for a different type of mission under the call sign Prairie Fire. Prairie Fire was a special forces mission run out of Saigon. These were road watch teams, small patrols of special forces along the Ho Chi Minh Trail. They would have indigenous mercenary-type personnel, usually no more on the team than 10 or 12, two or three American special forces sergeants working out of, in our case, Khantoum, north of Pleiku. These guys were the true warriors. These folks were under fire as soon as they were inserted into a landing zone. They would try to stay there 5 to 7 days. Sometimes it lasted half an hour. Our job was to put them in with helicopter, gunship, and fighter support, pull them out if need be. There were never more than 65 or 70 people at that one base that I used for special forces support. But in 7 years of combat, those folks were awarded 5 medals of honor.
Oh, my gosh.
One of their folks was well known because he was on the run under fire. They asked him how he was doing. He said, "I got them right where I want them, surrounded from the inside." Every time they were forced into combat, while they tried not to be and to stay under the radar, they were always up against odds of 150 to 1 or better. Everybody on those teams was wounded during the tour, usually more than once. There was a Mobile Army Surgical Hospital, LaMage, right next to my base at Pleiku. And it wasn't uncommon to spend 8 or 10 hours in a puddle of sweat in the cockpit all day and then go out and visit the folks that we'd pulled out that night.
Now, Rick, I've been warned against doing math in public, but how long were you in Vietnam?
Just under a year.
So just under a year, 325 missions. That's a mission a day.
Typical missions were 4.5 hours, but I also flew some maintenance certification flights after maintenance, make sure the airplanes were combat ready.
Now, you talked about you several radios on the aircraft. When you're airborne over a target, are you, in effect, not just sort of the operator, but you become the de facto air boss? I mean, can you tell someone where to drop or wave them off?
It was our strike to run, our wings on the line, our reputation. I had the same Covey 566 call sign all year. That was my integrity right there. And we could send people home if we didn't like what they were doing, rank included.
Mm-hmm.
One particular mission I had, a man got stranded on the ground. It was one American by himself with a Colt 45 and a survival radio, and we got him out, but it was all up to me.
Now, when we come back after the break, I want to talk about some particularly hairy missions. I think most of the general public, the civilians, they think about maybe part of your mission in the movie Bat 21 and the role that character, that forward air controller, played. And I know movies aren't 100% accurate, but what were the rules of engagement? Were you at some point in 1969, were all the gloves off, or were you still limited by certain things you could and couldn't do, where you could shoot, where you couldn't?
It depended entirely upon the area or the sector where you were working. Where I was, out country in Laos, where there supposedly were no Americans,
mm-hmm.
there were no rules. If they were near the trail, they were fair game. There were 50,000 NVA soldiers up there, right, driving the trucks, pushing the bicycles, repairing the roads with bulldozers, that sort of thing, and manning a gajillion guns to shoot back.
Now, if folks want to come out and actually see maybe not the plane you flew, but a plane you flew, where do they find it here at Pima Air and Space Museum? Where do they find the O2?
We do have an O2. It's a combat veteran, and it's right in front of one of our World War II hangars, hangar number 3. Out in front has the number 901 on the side. It's right there. We have an OV-10 right across from it, a Bronco. We also have some World War II liaison aircraft, like an L-5 Stinson in our main hangar.
Okay, and folks, that's one of the things I'm telling you. Come out and visit the PM and Air and Space Museum. Not only do you get to see the aircraft, but you actually get to meet the men, in some cases women, who flew these. Just what a great experience. We're broadcasting live from Pima Air and Space Museum, thanks to Nova Home Loans, 6000 East Valencia Road. We'll be right back. We'll be talking more with Rick about some of his missions in Vietnam flying the O2. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now, back to the American Warrior.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're broadcasting live on the road today, thanks to Nova Home Loans, from the Pima Air and Space Museum. I tell you, if you're listening in Tucson or you're hearing this podcast or streaming somewhere else around the world, if you get to Tucson, you have got to put this on your list. If you love aircraft, this is just a once-of-a-lifetime kind of a place to visit. It's not just the over 300 aircraft they have here, but also the availability of the volunteers. Many of them folks who flew missions in these aircraft. We're joined right now by Rick Felker. Rick was, among other things, a forward air controller, flew 325 missions over the Ho Chi Minh Trail, or as Rick likes to say, the Ho Chi Minh Superhighway, apparently there in Laos. Rick, coming back, I mentioned the Bat 21 movie and that rescue mission. Movies aren't 100% accurate, but there was an O2 or several that participated in that mission that brought out Lieutenant Colonel Gene Hamilton when he was shot down in Vietnam. How typical was that? Are there any particular missions that you recall of the 325 that were particularly hairy or particularly rewarding?
As I think I mentioned, working with Special Forces troops that were in road watch teams along the trail was where things got really nitty-gritty. They were small units. They were frequently being pursued and trying to evade and disengage from large numbers of enemy soldiers. Trying to help them get exfiltrated under fire was basically like working a search and rescue operation. Mm-hmm. We had 3 radios, VHF to talk to an airborne command post, UHF to talk to fighters, FM to talk to the troops on the ground. We would have an Army rider with us in the right seat. He could help liaise with his people back in Khantoum, where they were based. It was the very definition of multitasking. Besides listening to all 3 of those radios and sometimes more at the same time, you had to watch every fighter in the air above you, all the gunships down below you, lift ships in their areas that were going to get the troops out, the people on the ground, plus guns shooting around that area. So it was basically juggling about 8 balls when you got 2 arms to do it.
And you got to be flying a plane at the same time, by the way.
Yep, and a little bit of that, too. It's that interesting because it wasn't the heavy caliber 23-37mm guns, although smelling the cordite and seeing the airburst got a little bit exciting. But it was the small caliber, higher rate of fire guns, like the 50 caliber machine gun, mm-hmm. that could zip a wing off. I would have to follow a fighter down the chute when he dropped a bomb to make sure his nose was pointed in the right directions, because close air support, by definition, is they're close enough to the friendlies, you have to be very precise. But it was a case where we couldn't climb the way the fighters did after the pull-off, mm-hmm. so we kept getting lower and lower, and so we were pretty much down where they could throw rocks at us.
You know, I've heard fighter pilots or combat pilots tell me, you know, it's bad to be the first guy in, but you don't want to be the second guy in. It's the second airship that seems to take all the flack. And here you are in this little Cessna coming in afterwards. How many times did you come back with holes in your wings?
A few. But, you know, as improbable an airplane as the O2 was for the job, it was a communications platform. And even though you couldn't see out of it when I landed because of the grease pencil marks I had used to take notes all over the inside of the windshield, it still brought me home every time, so I can't complain about that. But it was there's no mission more complex than close air support. And a SAR is just a small unit version of that. There's also no mission more rewarding.
You now you mentioned on the Prairie Fire missions, you usually had somebody in the seat next to you. On a quarter, and I use the quotation fingers here in the air, on a normal mission, was it just you in the aircraft, or was there always somebody in the second seat?
Daytime we flew alone, just us. Nighttime we would have usually a navigator using one of the early Starlight scopes. He'd look out the open window. The nice thing about low speed, you can open a window.
Hmm.
And he was looking out trying to find the dimmed headlights of the trucks, and we'd vector in the fighters after that. With slash and burn vegetation around us and lots of humidity, a lot of times there'd be fires on the ground, stars in the sky, no horizon. It was made to order for vertigo, but the nice thing about that open window, when the noise of the winds picked up, you were in a dive. When the noise died down, you were in a climb.
These things they probably don't teach in flight school. You have to just maybe pick that up on the way, or
I have to admit that as a 24-year-old first lieutenant, being a FAC was all the responsibility I could ever ask for, and a great way to learn how to fly.
Now you'd mentioned that you're basically the boss up there, and you could send a colonel home if you needed to. How was that pretty well accepted? I mean, people,
yes.
Regardless of the chain of command. Okay.
It was my airstrike.
Okay.
No question.
Now, when you mentioned you're flying generally about 2,000 feet when you're in a circling, just so folks can get a perspective of that, when you see the police helicopter over Tucson, they're flying at about 500 feet, and they look pretty close. So you're pretty close to the ground. I'm guessing literally somebody that's within range of just some guy with an AK-47 if they choose to.
Yeah, AK-47s would reach about 1,500 feet, and we would nip the edge of that envelope easily. Like I said, the one we watched more often was the 50 caliber gun, and the machine gun would reach up around 5,000 feet. So we were in their envelope right in the middle.
Now, you were there principally in 1969, Rick. How did the mission evolve and change over the course of the war in Vietnam?
There was some variation in tempo due to various bombing pauses imposed by LBJ and McNamara. The enemy didn't care much for that. The bigger change we noticed was really seasonal. There was a monsoon season that made Tucson's monsoon look pretty tame. Heavy rains, bad weather 20 hours out of 24.
Hmm.
And when that happened, the tempo of operations would slack off some. But again, we were up 24/7 into it. So that made a difference, but not to the rate at which we flew.
Now, is one of the other advantages of the O2, the aircraft you're flying, was that you didn't need a nice paved airstrip, right? It's propeller-driven. You could take off from some, let's say, unimproved country if you needed to, or
the airplane weighed about 4,800 pounds, and it was right at gross and over gross weight. The engines were decent engines, but we would use easily 4,000 feet getting off the ground. It should land fairly short, but takeoff is another matter. Picking up the Army riders with us at Khantoum, their airfield, I remember to this day, was 3,609 feet long, and I used every foot of it. We would close the cowl flaps, take the higher temperatures for a while, get up over the ridge at the end of the runway, then come down into ground effect over the river that was there, past the hooks along the way, and then finally pull the gear up after that.
Do you ever land with any palm fronds in your gear?
No, but there were times when we had to get down in amongst them.
Okay. Now, you ended your career, I think, well, I shouldn't say you ended your career, but you also flew A-7 aircraft out of Davis-Monthan here for a couple of years.
Great machine. If it's permissible to say it, we used to say that was the airplane where it was the most fun you could have with your clothes on.
I think it's a family show, but I think we'll let you get away with that, Rick. It just some of the cachet you'll get by visiting here at the P. Marin Space Museum. What message would you like to leave our listeners with about your time in Vietnam and your time in the service?
No more rewarding mission than close air support. I worked with heroes.
I'm going to just let that sit because that's pretty powerful there. Folks, if you could be here and see the expression on his face, I think you'd really appreciate that. Why did you come to Pima Air and Space Museum? You're one of many volunteers that think really add strength and flavor to the experience when folks come here and visit. What was your decision to come out here?
Every airplane out here is a dream come true. This is a place where technology was applied to change the world. We have thousands of school kids out here free every year. And I always tell them, Aviation is like any of the great human endeavors. It tells you what you can do if you put your mind to it, and it shows you who you can be if you put your heart in it.
Wow, that is so wonderful. Is there an opportunity on a regular basis, Rick, where folks can come out and hear some of you speak? Are there, like, monthly presentations or I mean, a scheduled time when they come out and hear you share your thoughts about that aircraft?
Sure. We do. We have a volunteer presentation series that the volunteers do. We have volunteers telling their experiences, several guest speakers. That's usually the third Saturday, all except for the summertime at 10 o'clock. We also have a museum-sponsored second Saturday feature, second Friday. I believe that's Friday. At any rate, that's here usually inside the main hangar, and our education department puts that on. Some great speakers from the university, from aviation historians, all brands and types of historians.
Well, Rick, thank you so much for your service. Folks, we are broadcasting live from Pima Air and Space Museum. We are in the big main hangar. That sound you hear on occasion on the back of us, Rick, is that a Huey firing up back behind us?
Yeah,
is that?
That's a UHM model. It was used as a gunship for the armed escort mission. We also have a later version, the Huey Cobra, in the same hangar that took on that same job.
This is like asking a parent which child they love the most, but after the planes you flew, what is one of your favorite displays here?
I like to talk about the Blackbird. Usually we can tell people this is going to pay your gee whiz meter.
It's just one of the many aircraft you'll see out here, folks. I think they still have one of the Air Force Ones on display here. We'll check in with Scott Marchand, the director of Pima Air and Space Museum. Stick around, folks. We've got 1 second when we come back. Thanks to Nova Home Loans for putting American Warrior on the road today. We're broadcasting live from Pima Air and Space Museum. Check it out, pimaair.org. We'll be right back.
If you want to discuss those who serve the red, white, and blue, dial 520-751-1041. Now, back to the American Warrior.
Welcome back to American Warrior, ladies and gentlemen. Your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're on the road today. We're broadcasting live from the Pima Air and Space Museum, the largest privately funded aircraft and aerospace museum in the world, probably. I'm going to claim that, Scott.
Sure.
It's my show.
I will just make one small clarification. Private funding sort of suggests that we don't need to earn our keep. And in actual fact, when you say privately funding, I mean, what we mean is we're not government supported. So we are entirely self-supporting through our revenues that we generate through ticket sales and tours and all the rest. So we're a very entrepreneurial organization. So every bit of support helps.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. We just heard a great story from Rick Felker. You've got other docents out here. Previously, we had a young lady on the show who actually manned one of the ICBM sites,
right,
or I guess the ICBM site down at the Titan II Museum.
Yep.
That's part of your, again, another absolutely do not miss opportunity. I mean, living history.
Sure.
They go down there and they actually do a launch.
Simulated launch, yeah.
And it still makes the hair go up on the back of my neck when I watch that. But what is the oldest? I think you still have some World War II folks here, right? Or
we have a couple. It's a weird thing. You know, people come in and go to the hangars and they see, you know, the older guys out there and they sort of, you know, want to connect them to the airplanes they're standing in front of. And, you know, often case now our volunteer demographic is, you know, sort of, you know, Rick's era and, you know, they're getting a little bit long in the tooth, but, you know, they're the sons of the World War II generation, you know. That greatest generation is really heading into the sunset. So we have, I think, three or four left who are still coming out on a regular basis. End of the 390th Memorial Museum here, I think they have one or two left. But, you know, we're really getting into the twilight of that generation. So, you know, if you have an interest and want to hear firsthand, you know, now's the time to come out and do it because the opportunities are diminishing.
And I'm so glad you said that, Scott, because frankly, that's the reason we do this show. People need to hear these stories. They need to hear the living history from the folks that were there, I think, to better comprehend what our men and women in the military are going through. We're talking off the air. I came out to present an award, an Employer Supported Guard and Reserve Award, to one of your supervisors here.
Yep.
The young man who works here is a Navy reservist. He's working on a World War II aircraft that you've acquired. He's helping to get it in shape to put it on the...
Yeah, that'd be Patrick. He's our exhibits manager, and he's helping with the restoration of the IL-2 Sturmvictor we're working on. It's a big collaborative effort that everybody from myself down to, you know, daily volunteers and staff and in between, we're all contributing our time and passion towards that restoration.
And that was a Russian... fighter bomber?
Yeah, the IL-2 Sturmovik is one of these unsung heroes. I mean, if you really wanted to point to an aircraft that was instrumental in victory in the Second World War, that would be it. It is, to this date, the most produced military aircraft in history, with slightly fewer than 37,000 built between 1941 and 1945. The only other aircraft that's been produced in higher numbers is the Cessna 172. And the Sturmovik is in very... It's a rare beast. There's one flying up in Seattle. There's maybe 8 to 10 intact examples in museums around the world, and we're very fortunate to have one of the very earliest known survivors.
We kind of teased this question in the first segment when we had you on, Scott, about what it, kind of walk me through how you actually identify and acquire an aircraft. Is there... I joke, you don't buy an SR-71 on Amazon.com, right? But I should have said that. They're not an advertiser. But what, yeah. I mean, do you get
Nova will finance you one for one.
There we go. Do you get leads from people? Is there a bulletin board? Or, you know, kind of like the zoo saying, hey, we just had a new baby tiger born.
You know, it's an art, it's a science, it's a personality, and it's a pro forma. You know, there are established protocols for requesting and acquiring loan aircraft from the federal programs that the Air Force, the Navy, and the Marine Corps run. But then after that, it's just a matter of, you know, taking initiative and beating the bushes and getting to meet people and expressing interest and, you know, chasing down these legends or the cryptic tips that people leave with you. You know, a lot of it's people do things for people. You know, I mean, you're the organization you represent is often the gate. You know, it opens the door for you. But after that, it's really up to, you know, the people, the personalities involved to sort of have mutual support, interest, and agreement, and, you know, further each other's mission. So we work closely with a lot of other museums around the country and around the world. You know, a good example of that is recently we've acquired on loan from the Royal Air Force Museum in the United Kingdom, Spitfire Mark 14E, which is over in Hangar 5 right now. And it's the first time they've made a loan to an American Air and Space Museum.
I'm just trying to imagine the logistics of it. It's not like I've got a book that I circulate from libraries. Rick was sort of joking about what it looked like when you were actually moving in one of these big bombers in Tucson. And I love your quote. You said something about it only gets so small before you can put it back together again.
Right. Yeah.
What is that? I mean...
Well, Rick was talking about when we acquired the B-36 Peacemaker about 10 years ago now, and that had been out in Fort Worth in Texas, and it had a bit of a checkered past. I mean, a very passionate group in Fort Worth, you know, all due credit to them for keeping it in existence long enough for it to come here, but they were having troubles, you know, gaining interest in the community to, you know, to make it viable to keep it there for display, and it was already... partially disassembled at the Lockheed facility in Fort Worth, and they needed that facility back, so the Air Force approached us looking for a new home for it, and we gamely took on the project. And the first, you know, several loads, I mean, I was out there and taking apart the aircraft and rigging the loads and coordinating all the logistics behind that, and it was all really smooth sailing, but the real... the hurdle was the wing center box section. So the wing on that aircraft is built in three pieces. There's two outer panels, and there's a center section that spans the fuselage, carries the engines, most of the fuel, and it's really the solid bridge structure that enables the aircraft to carry the payload that it does. And obviously these things are built from smaller pieces, but there comes a practical point where if you actually want to keep it together, you don't take it down much smaller. And this wing center section that we ended up moving, the smallest we could make it and move it and still have a hope of putting the airplane back together, it was 145 feet long, 29 feet wide, and 13 feet tall. So just a pro tip here, the legal maximum road width for moving anything on a highway is 30 feet. So we had 6 inches of clearance on either side. And, you know, we were really fortunate there was a local company here in Tucson that does a lot of exotic rigging and moving for the mines. And they went out there with a 110-foot long triple gooseneck, double triple drop deck, triple 10 rear steerable flat deck, loaded this thing up in Fort Worth and went straight down the I-10 at 55 miles an hour over 2.5 days with about 30 police escorts front and back blocking traffic and until they got it here.
I'm guessing they got one or two gawkers somewhere between Texas and
yeah,
Arizona.
Yeah, it was not a typical sight on the I-10.
Suffice to say, though, if an aircraft is here, generally is it going to stay here?
Generally, yes. I mean, there's been occasions in the past where we've had duplicate aircraft or, you know, things that were similar enough to things we already had in the collection. I mean, you know, one mark of a maturing organization is being able to let go of some of the early things you have mm-hmm. that don't really fit your mission, or maybe they are better suited in a different organization or different location because it has a stronger historical connection to that. To that community or agency. So, we have done some trades, we have done some sales, but generally speaking, yeah, we're a bit of a lobster trap. You know, things come in, they don't go out.
Okay. Now, Rick mentioned you've got some other events coming up. The second Saturday speaker series, your next one, if I'm not mistaken, is May 13th. That's at both 1:30 and 2:30 p.m. here at the Pima Air and Space Museum. It's no secret, Scott, it gets a little toasty in Tucson in the summertime.
Sure.
Many of your aircraft are outdoors, but you are accommodating that during the summers for folks who want to come out and enjoy the evenings here in Tucson. Tell us about that.
Yeah, for 3 Saturdays over the summer, one in each month, June, July, and August. Check the website. We're open on a Saturday night. It's called Night Wings. It's free for children under 12, and adults have a reduced rate admission. And there's lots of activities out here. We typically have, you know, some of the science and technology groups out here, like the Physics Factory. We have other community volunteers from Raytheon and the base who mm-hmm. come out and, you know, lead crafting sessions or making paper airplanes or seltzer rockets. And it's also just a good opportunity to wander around and check out the displays, have an ice cream in the restaurant here. You know, one thing that's really kind of nice, too, in the summer, you know, everybody knows the sunsets out here are just phenomenal, and it's a great opportunity to do some photography with a different sort of backdrop than you normally get when it's, you know, stark blue skies and lots of white washout, you know, so there's great opportunities if you're a photo bug, and it's a very different atmosphere. It's much more, it feels a little more intimate, so it's a great thing to take part in.
Two real quick things. One is, I've always said that volunteers are the high-octane jet fuel of nonprofits. If you're someone like me who doesn't have Rick's experience, yeah. but I just want to help, can I pick up trash? Can I, you know, wash
oh,
aircraft
sure.
or
we,
something?
Oh, sure. We are happy to, you know, if you've got a positive attitude and you're willing to, you know, be flexible and cheerful, you know, we're happy to have you. We've got a training program, we've got a recruitment program, you know, we contact our volunteer coordinator here. There's lots of different opportunities. You don't have to live, breathe, eat, and sleep this stuff. You mm-hmm. can be, you know, retired school teacher, you can be a 16-year-old high school student. Our attitude with sort of collecting goes to the volunteers. Well, it's kind of like the Hard Rock Cafe. You know, we love all, take all. You know, it's really about just bringing, you know, positive enthusiasm to our mission. So
we've got about a minute and a half left, Scott. But one thing I also want to mention that people may not necessarily know, what a great venue that can be open for special events. I was out here for a Navy ball once. You had it in the hangar with the aircraft as a backdrop.
Sure.
You do your own catering. You've got a restaurant here.
Yeah.
Folks can just contact you to book that, or how do they go about?
Oh, we have a contracted events coordinator, Gwen Jones, who is able to better serve everybody's needs and with respect to hospitality here. But yeah, but we definitely have the capacity to host large and small groups out here. You know, depends on your budget and expectations. I mean, you know, struggle if we're kind of on the wrong side of town for most of the hospitality venues, but we draw a fair share of, you know, it's worth the trek.
Yeah, I mean, this is something I'd cross the country or go around the globe to see. Honestly, this is just such a special place. We're very fortunate to have it right here in Tucson. I assume if folks have a foundation or maybe somebody would like to write you into their will, they can just go to PimaAir.org and find out how to do that as well?
Oh, yeah. We've got a contact list there. We're always welcoming support from anywhere we can get it. It takes a lot to feed these animals, too.
Yes, no quiz. And you can probably put names. Now, if I want to have, like, my name on the slit trench display, can we just make that the BBG for the right price?
For the right price, yeah.
Scott, thank you so much for having us out here at Pima Air and Space Museum. Rick Felger, thanks for your time here. Thanks to Sean and Tiffany Denlinger from the Denlinger team at Nova Home Loans. What a great opportunity, folks. You can come out and visit the museum, 6000 East Valencia Road. They've got great educational programs for the young ones, too, as well. Everything from flying paper airplanes to learning about space. What a fabulous, fabulous resource that you've built here in Tucson. Scott, thank you so much.